yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber bands straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today is the anniversary of the 2008 banking crash. Remember Lehman Brothers? Can't forget that. And I think it's time maybe to put that in perspective. They're beginning to get, writings on it in the business press and trying to figure it out and so forth. And is it relevant for today, et cetera? And, of course, it is relevant for today. But most do not fully understand what actually happened in 2008. And today we're going to start talking about that and continue probably next week. It's a big topic. And I don't want to do it just in a narrative of what happened. There's lots of books on that. I wrote about that in 2010 in my book, Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression, in great detail. So I have a perspective and a view on that, which I will talk about. But I think it's important to put the analysis of the 2008 crash in perspective, not only to prior financial crises, but to what's going on today. You know, we really need to understand that in relationship to what's going on today. As I've been talking about on this show, increasingly there are signs of global financial instability, or as I call it, fragility, which is a condition in the financial markets that is an indicator of a financial instability event. You know, a financial instability event could be a stock market crash. It could be subprime mortgages and a derivatives crash, as it occurred in 2008. It might be a currency crisis and a sovereign debt crisis, which occurred in 1997-98. It could be technology company sector bust as in 2001. It could be a housing crisis as it happened in the late 80s in the U.S., or a sovereign debt crisis and happened in Mexico and other places in the 90s. These are all financial instability events. And sometimes they are controlled and resolved, but sometimes they run out of control, like that happened in 2008. And then you get contagion. Contagion across financial markets is a key to understanding whether you have a true financial instability event like 2008 or whether you have one that's controlled like 1997-98 and the dot-com bust, etc. So, we want to talk about contagion, financial contagion between financial markets. And we also want to talk about contagion across financial markets and the real economy. How do we understand contagion? Okay, that's a key point. And it's a key element that most analyses of 2008-09 don't really address. You know, contagion across financial markets, like stock markets, bond markets, property markets, currency markets. You know, how does this financial instability propagate from one market to the next? That's important to understand. You know, a week or so ago, I joined the debate between Dean Baker, and The New York Times. Dean had criticized an article in the New York Times, writer there, I forget his name, for arguing, New York Times argued that, the bond market, the corporate bond market is, a source of danger here in the U.S. And Dean's reply was, no, no, it's not. And Dean then gave his view of Lehman Brothers. Okay, so that particular analysis, I think, is wrong, because Dean doesn't say anything about contagion. The bond market, corporate bond markets, are a potential source of trouble in the U.S. as far as financial instability is concerned. You know, over half of all corporate bonds and municipal bonds are what's called junk grade bonds. High yield junk grade bonds. Now, what do we mean by junk grade, and why is that important? Well, junk grade means that the companies, or the cities in this case, munis, are not very financially sound, meaning they have a large amount of debt. And that debt is not just large, but they're paying higher interest on that debt, because the companies are not in good financial condition. What that means is that when you have a next financial crisis, those companies may not be able to get the loans to roll over that debt or reissue bonds, except at extremely high interest rates. And they may not be able to roll it over. Well, if a company can't roll over its debt, and debt is large, you know, large magnitude, and the terms and conditions are not very favorable to the company, then the company defaults. Default meaning it doesn't pay its principal and interest on the debt. And when that happens, of course, it goes bankrupt. And its assets get sold off by bankruptcy courts, and the value of its stock crashes to zero. And everybody loses money and so forth. And whoever loaned them or bought their debt, large amount of that debt, are now holding a worthless debt, right? And they stand in line in the bankruptcy court and get pennies on it. And then they, whoever loaned them the money, take the losses as well. Usually banks or shadow banks or investors. The corporate bond market may not precipitate a financial crisis, but it certainly will contribute to it. And that's where most analyses of what happened in 2008 go wrong. They don't understand the differences between the different causative forces. By causative forces, I mean some causes are fundamental to the crisis. Some causes enable the crisis, and some causes precipitate the crisis. There's a difference, qualitative difference, between different kinds of causation, and most economists don't make that distinction. In this debate between Baker and New York Times, there was no distinction between that, the different types of causes, or the role that contagion can play. And does play in unforeseen ways, you see, between different banks and financial institutions and non-financial institutions and so forth, right? What are the transmission mechanisms that set off these crises and propagate the contagion between the different sectors? And what are the causative forces? Well, if you look around today, we have some very interesting instabilities growing in the global economy. The most obvious is what's happening with emerging markets, emerging market economies. And in the news significantly are those emerging markets like Argentina and Turkey and others, Brazil and so forth. And the problem there is a currency. The collapse of their currency. A collapse, by the way, driven largely by two forces. One, which is the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Federal Reserve, raising interest rates, which raise the value of the dollar. And as the dollar rises, the currencies of these countries, let's take Argentina, collapse. Argentina's currency has collapsed more than 50% in 1 year. Now, that's a big problem for Argentina because Argentina has borrowed a lot of money, bonds, issued bonds, borrowed money in dollars. It's dollarized debt. In other words, they have to pay off that dollarized debt, that interest and principal, only with dollars. But when their currency collapses, they can buy fewer dollars with the currency. It buys fewer dollars. And when the global economy slows down, well, then in the case of Argentina and others, they earn fewer dollars. So they're caught between a rock and a hard place. They're earning fewer dollars because of the slowdown of exports in the global economy, one. And they have to pay more in their currency to buy dollars to pay the principal and interest on their debt. It's a formula for crisis. And so what does Argentina and these other countries do? Well, what they do is raise their domestic interest rates in order to prevent another problem, which is when your currency is collapsing, your investors and others want to sell that currency before it collapses more and buy dollars. Well, that means the currency collapses even further as you throw more of your Argentine pesos on the market. You increase the supply, the price declines. And if you're buying dollars, you drive up the value of the dollar even more than the Fed, and the dollar is rising because of Fed hikes. So that becomes another force for driving up the value of dollar, which drives down the value of your currency even further. And then you get the problem, another third layer here of foreign investors don't want to invest their dollars in Argentina because the currency is falling. So they reduce their foreign direct investment into Argentina. And that means Argentina has even fewer dollars. So it becomes a vicious cycle here. And that's what's going on. Argentina is, of course, the point of the spear of this. Turkey is right up there as well. Same thing happening in Turkey. And the currencies continue to collapse as foreign direct investment drives up, as the ability to earn dollars declines, to pay dollarized debt, which rises in cost as the Fed and the U.S. dollar rises. You see how all these things come together to force this continued contagion. Now, these forces are all continuing to occur in the global economy as global trade slows down. And of course, Trump's threats and warnings make the global trade issue even more of a problem or a possibility, a slowdown of global trade. Okay, so what we got here is a locus of financial instability in emerging markets, and it's focused largely
Hello.
Right now.
Final attempt to reach you.
It's focused largely on these economies that are heavily involved in dollarized debt or dollar or euro. Euroized debt in the case of Turkey and dollarized debt in the case of Turkey. But we're beginning to see a contagion, a spread of the currency instability beyond just Argentina and Turkey. In other words, contagion beginning to occur, currency to currency contagion. Right, we see South Africa, we see other countries, Brazil's real, Indonesia, the rupiah, and India, the rupee. So one channel of contagion is currency to currency. Now, we're also beginning to see a contagion effect from currencies to stock markets in those countries. The stock markets are beginning to decline sharply in those countries. So we're seeing one financial market, currencies, foreign exchange, now spilling over and causing instability and declines in the stock markets in emerging market economies. The question is, will that stock market instability and declines in those emerging markets spread to the stock markets of the advanced economies in Europe, in North Asia, Northeast Asia, particularly Japan, South Korea, and China, or not, and the U.S., or not? You know, that would be another degree of contagion going on. There's another possibility that needs to be watched closely too, and that is the contagion effect across financial markets from stock markets to bond markets. So we have very clearly contagion going on currency to currency markets. We have contagion beginning to emerge from currency to stock markets, whether it'll go stock to stock markets, emerging to advanced economy stock markets is one thing. But now the thing to watch is, will it spill over to the bond markets? And there's two kinds of bond markets to watch in particular. One is the sovereign government bond markets, and the other is corporate bond markets in those countries. And even within corporate markets, you have two categories. One is high-yield junk bond markets and investment-grade markets. Usually it's investment-grade is the last to really feel the impact. And then after that, or even in the whole process here, not necessarily linear, in the whole process is what's happening to the derivatives markets, derivatives. You know, subprime mortgages were derivatives. Credit default swaps were derivatives. I'm talking about the 2008-09 crash. Mm-hmm. The derivatives today to watch, I believe, are exchange-traded funds. Very dangerous, right? Derivatives are simply financial securities that are created off of other financial securities. That's all a derivative is. But derivatives cause an acceleration of the contagion and a deeper contraction of the crisis once it starts, which brings us back to what happened to Lehman, right? So far, we've been talking about financial instability locations here in the global economy, you know, currencies, stock markets, currency exchange markets, stock markets, sovereign debt markets, corporate bond markets, and so forth, right? Okay, these are areas to watch for instability. And, you know, very clearly the EMEs, emerging market economies, are a locus of financial instability that seems to be deteriorating. But let's go back to 2008-09. And let's keep in mind this three ways of looking at causation: fundamental causes, enabling causes, and precipitating causes. You know, there's a whole area of thought and analysis that says, "Oh, the crisis in 2008 was caused by deregulation of financial markets, and that was the whole thing, right?" Well, yes, financial deregulation enabled the expansion and development of derivatives, and the linkage of derivatives and off-balance sheet investments that were hidden, you know, as contributing causes, enabling and contributing causes. Certainly, you know, technology was part of it. But technology, banking, financial technology, is not the whole story. It's not even fundamental, in my opinion. It's enabling, but not. It wasn't fundamental. The fundamental cause has been since the 1970s, central banks just pumping massive amounts of liquidity into the banking systems. With the collapse of what was called the Bretton Woods system in the 1970s, you no longer had the dollar and gold as the basis for stabilizing currency exchange rates. The central banks had to do it themselves, and they were freed to pump as much money as they wanted into the economy, into the banking, their banking. And they did so. My book, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, discusses this historical development, which begins in the late 1970s. Another key development was the elimination of controls on global capital flows in the 1980s, led by the U.S. and the U.K., and then followed by everybody else, so that money capital could flow across the world without interference and without any kind of control. And then, you know, of course, you get the technology, digital technology, and, you know, the role played by networks, right? You network internet and you network the global economy, and money can not only flow, but flow instantaneously. So massive money injections, which meant that businesses, corporations, investors could borrow money cheap and invest it in financial markets. And, of course, that began an acceleration of the growth of financial markets. That then, because there was so much money out there, banks and investors started creating new kinds of financial securities. And thus we have the development of derivatives of various kinds, or what's called securitization, right? And speculators start just not only buying traditional stocks and bonds, but start buying derivatives. And of course, derivatives totally unregulated, and a lot of money flows into it. So, you know, we have these fundamental forces of the central bank being a main contributor, and the end of global capital flows, and deregulation plays a role. Because if you want to move money around, you get rid of regulations on money flows, both domestically and globally. So deregulation plays a role, but it's an enabling, contributing role. And technology accelerates the movement of money capital. That plays a role as well. And where does this money go that was being created? Well, in the 90s, it went into sovereign debt, you know, loaning money, banks, U.S. banks loaning money within the IMF often, loaning money to these emerging markets, getting in there on the ground floor in Mexico and so forth, and also flowed into Asian currencies. And then you get the speculators, the private speculators who jump in, who exacerbate the price flows up and down. And, of course, we get the Asian crisis, 1997-98, which transforms into a sovereign debt crisis. So currency crises in 1997-98, it was called, and sovereign debt crises that followed. By the way, Argentina was one of them that collapsed because of speculators and currency crises and sovereign debt crises. And we're seeing a repeat of that now in Argentina. And the banks had to be bailed out, the U.S. banks that had loaned a lot of money to speculators in Asia. That means the Federal Reserve loans them the money real cheap to bail them out, and pushes more money into the global economy. And that's what happened in 1997-98. The speculators then turn and pump money into the tech sector. And we get the tech bust in 2001, which was followed by the Federal Reserve pumping money into the economy once again, excessively. Then we get, a weak recovery in the early 2000s in the U.S. And once again, Alan Greenspan, the chair of the Federal Reserve, along with George W. Bush, say, okay, let's pump up the residential markets here, housing markets in the U.S. You see, the housing market had begun to boom in the late 90s, and by 2001, too, it had pretty much completed its cycle of 7-year cycle typically in residential housing, but they artificially boosted it up even further. They, meaning Bush and Greenspan, to get the economy going in 2002-03, so Bush could get reelected once again. And that artificially boosted the housing market. At the same time, the deregulation allowed banks to put their bad loans on off balance sheet institutions, you know, hide their bad loans, and also to create subprime mortgages. What's a subprime mortgage? It's just a derivative. That's all. You take a mortgage on a real home, right? It's the reflection, the financial reflection of the value of that real property. But then you take the mortgage and you combine the mortgages into mortgage bonds. That's a derivative. You see, mortgage bonds become a derivative of mortgages. And then you sell those mortgage bonds. You chop them up into what's called tranches, and you sell pieces of the mortgage bonds globally, all around the world. And because the housing market, the good buyers that already bought homes from 97 to 2005, 4, 3 and 4, 5, you got to get people to buy the houses that you want to write these mortgages and subprimes on. And you get people who really can't afford to buy them, but you suck them in with liar loans. In other words, we don't care whether you can afford to pay them. You keep interest rates at 1%, variable rates at 1%, right? You fast track the writing of the mortgages and so forth, and you get millions of people buying houses and mortgages that are then sold immediately by the banks around the world in pieces, right? And that's the subprime mortgage crisis. And then, of course, once interest rates start rising, and they did starting in 2005 and 6, right? Then those people that bought those homes that couldn't afford to buy those homes, that were sucked into buying those homes to artificially keep the economy going, they no longer can pay the principal and interest on the loans because the interest rates are now rising. They're variable interest rates, another element of subprimes, you see. So the interest rates are rising. They can't pay their homes, their mortgage on their homes, and they turn in the keys. And the banks got to take over those homes and write off the loss on those homes. And then the balance sheets of the banks, first the mortgage banks, Countrywide and others, collapse. But then, you know, in this whole process, it's not just you have subprime mortgages, but what you got was bets, another form of derivative called collateralized debt obligations. In other words, you take these mortgage bonds and you merge them with other mortgage bonds and other forms of derivatives, asset-backed securities, and so forth, and you form a CDO, collateralized debt obligation. And you mark the price up on that 20%, just as you mark the mortgage bond price up 20% over the mortgages themselves. And you sell them to speculators and investors around the world, because it's a global economy now. You can move money around because there's no controls on money flows, you see. So, you know, you have another form of derivative on top of a derivative. You had the mortgage bond, right? And now you have collateralized debt obligations, and you then create another derivative on top of those derivatives, and that's called a credit default swap, a CDS, which is really a contract, insurance contract, that you get paid if the thing crashes. Okay, so you got layers and layers of derivatives. You see, it's Baker's wrong. It's not just the subprime mortgage housing crash. It was this whole edifice of financial derivatives that were created. The mortgage, subprime mortgages, just being one of a larger structure of derivatives. Now, when the housing prices collapse, okay? When the housing prices collapse, then of course, the housing crisis precipitates the crash of the other derivatives. You know, the whole house of cards begins to come down. Derivative house of cards begin to come down. All right. And that's what began to happen. But you've got to understand this was a derivatives financial structure of which subprime mortgages were only one. And of course, they precipitated. But the crash of 2008 was about the derivatives crash. And the institutions that hold these derivatives and subprime mortgages, for example, Lehman Brothers bought a whole box of subprime mortgages late. It bought the subprime mortgages that got into the mortgage business after the prices had peaked. And this was like 2005-06, and it just, you know, holding these mortgages when the prices collapsed. So Lehman Brothers had losses because of the collapse of the subprime mortgages it held. Now, Lehman Brothers and other investment banks like it, Bear Stearns and others, only function based upon loans that they get when they need them from the commercial banks. Bear Stearns, another similar player early in 2008, bought into the subprime mortgage game, right? Had some losses, and its big lender was J.P. Morgan Chase, a commercial bank. J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, conveniently, regularly provided lending to Bear Stearns. An investment bank, or what we call a shadow bank, right? This was typical. You know, it happens. It still happens all the time because investment banks and shadow banks, which include insurance companies, finance companies, you know, a whole list of various types of financial institutions that aren't commercial banks, they typically don't keep any reserves for emergency. They lend everything out, and they lend for their big wealthy investors in high-risk areas because the wealthy investors don't want 2 and 3% returns. They want 10 and 20% returns, and well, you got to invest in risky opportunities for that. So investment banks, that's what they do. They take the money from their wealthy depositors, not you and me, and they speculate in high-risk, high-return markets. And to do that, they commit all of their reserves on hand. And when they have a problem, you know, with some losses, they turn to the commercial banks like Chase, and Chase gives them loans. Well, what happened with Bear Stearns in March of 2008 was Chase decided not to give Bear Stearns any more loans, which made Bear Stearns collapse. If they couldn't get loans, the speculators jumped in and drove down the stock of Bear Stearns. And Bear Stearns had to be bailed out by the Federal Reserve, forming an alliance with Chase to buy Bear Stearns for pennies. Actually, the Federal Reserve loaned Chase, a billion-dollar company, loaned them the money to buy Bear Stearns, $29 billion. Chase would not buy Bear Stearns by itself, so the government underwrote it, and Chase got Bear Stearns for pennies. Bear Stearns' office building in New York City, Manhattan, was worth $100 billion. And they paid only $29 billion for the whole company, you see. There was some renegotiation after that because it was too obvious to steal. Well, you could argue that Chase engineered the collapse of Bear Stearns to be able to scoop it up for pennies. And that's what happened. And the Federal Reserve played the game with them. Okay, so then we move on to Lehman Brothers, a company exactly like Bear Stearns, an investment shadow bank, right, that had overinvested in mortgages, which were then collapsing at the time. Lehman did not have the reserves like all such banks, investment banks. They borrow from commercial banks, right? And then you get Lehman Brothers, because it was having losses and couldn't get loans from other banks, its stock price began to collapse. Speculators jump in and short the price of the stock to make money. You make money on stocks collapsing, you know, if you're an investor, just as you make money on stocks rising. It's called shorting the stock. You know, Lehman Brothers stock was down to near zero. And Lehman then turned to the government, the Federal Reserve, and said, hey, look, you know, you bailed out Bear Stearns. You know, why can't you form some sort of agreement with another commercial bank to, you know, Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, to bail us out too, right? You did it once, and not with us. Well, but the government, by the way, at this time, refused to do that. The U.S. Treasury refused to help Lehman Brothers bail out. The Fed was not involved. The Fed had spent all of its money bailing out all of its available liquidity, bailing out Bear Stearns. So the Fed said, we can't do anymore, and turned it over to the U.S. Treasury, you see, to bail out. And the Treasury bailed out these government entities called Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac mortgage entities in July of 2008. And now we got brokerages, you know, like Merrill Lynch beginning to have losses. And in other words, contagion was growing. And Lehman Brothers, you know, which brings us up to September 2008, the Lehman Brothers affair. Well, the Treasury, run by Hank Paulson, refused to bail out Lehman Brothers, refused to arrange a bailout for Lehman, unlike the Fed bailout of Bear Stearns six months previous, and unlike having already bailed out Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac in July to the tune of $300 billion. The Treasury balked. Hank Paulson balked at bailing out Lehman. They decided to let Lehman go under. Well, why did they decide to let Lehman go under when they had bailed out Fannie Mae and Bear Stearns? Well, I think that has something to do with the fact that Hank Paulson was a former CEO of Goldman Sachs. He had just left Goldman Sachs in 2006 to take over the U.S. Treasury. Okay, a CEO of Goldman Sachs. So what's the connection between Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers? Well, there is no direct connection between Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers. But there is a distinct connection between Goldman Sachs and AIG, the largest then insurance company, also a shadow bank insurance company, in the U.S., maybe even in the world, AIG, right? Now, it gets a little more interesting here. AIG had written credit default swaps to the tune of, I don't know, $100 billion of credit default swaps. I don't know the exact number, on Lehman Brothers. So in other words, if Lehman Brothers collapses, whoever is holding the credit default swaps issued by AIG would collect from AIG on its bet that Lehman Brothers would go under, you see. Now, guess who was holding most of the credit default swaps with AIG on Lehman Brothers? It was Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs was going to make a lot of money on derivative CDS claims from AIG if Lehman Brothers collapses. Hank Paulson, who had just left Goldman Sachs, allows Lehman Brothers to go under. AIG has to pay Goldman Sachs billions and billions. I don't know how many total billions it paid, which meant AIG was now broke, because AIG wrote more credit default swaps on Lehman than it had money to pay off because it believed, well, you know, they're not going to fall. We can keep writing all these credit default swaps and making money on issuing CDSs, and Lehman's not going to fall. Well, Lehman was allowed to fall. And, of course, Goldman Sachs made a lot of money. And, of course, AIG went broke. It was then that the government bailed out AIG to the tune of $180 billion, you see. Well, you know, that was just $180 billion, really, if you follow the thread, payoff to Goldman Sachs. Really, that's where it leads to. So, in other words, these collapses in 2008 of the banking system have a lot of shady dealings involved between different financial institutions, commercial and non-commercial, Chase with Bear Stearns and the Federal Reserve. And then, of course, we have Goldman Sachs and Hank Paulson and AIG and Lehman Brothers collapse. Well, when Lehman Brothers was allowed to collapse, you know, it just set off then a chain reaction across the board of derivatives, claims, as other banks like Merrill Lynch and Washington Mutual and so forth began to collapse. And the financial arms of the auto companies, right? General Motors Acceptance Corporation, which is just the financing of dealerships, of purchases, right? And General Electric Finance, right? These are called finance companies. They're shadow banks, too. And those two, GE Finance and General Motors Finance, guess what? Invested heavily in subprime mortgages, and that brought down those two companies, or threatened to. The losses in General Motors at the time were almost totally losses on the finance side. So the government had to bail out those entities, those GE Finance and General Motors Finance and the auto industry, to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars as well. This was all bailout money that was financed by what was called the Troubled Asset Relief Program. Hank Paulson, once all this began to happen and spread and multiply by late September, Paulson went to Congress and said, I need a blank check for $750 billion. Yeah, he had a one-page proposal to Congress, right? To stop this financial crash, we need $750 billion. Congress at first choked on the whole idea, said, no, you know, a blank check for $750. You know, our constituents aren't going to like that very much, right? And, you know, banks that are causing this crisis to be bailed out at taxpayer expense for $750 billion, right? Well, it was getting so bad that Congress did write the check for $750 billion. And Hank Paulson bails out AIG, $100 billion, more than $100 billion. Bails out the auto companies and the finance companies and other entities, arranged the merger of Washington Mutual and Merrill Lynch and so forth. And then they had to underwrite, the government had to underwrite and bail out Citicorp, big bank that had invested too much in the same area, Bank of America that had bought this mortgage company just a few years before called Countrywide that went bankrupt, right? So they had to bail out hundreds of billions of dollars. Bank America and Citibank were totally bankrupt technically at the time, and the government just wouldn't let them go under. So the TARP was used in part to bail out them. Them meaning Citibank and Bank of America to bail out the auto companies, finance arms to bail out AIG and so forth, right? Everything was spreading. But the spread was propagated, right, and accelerated by the derivatives that had been written, CDSs, CDOs, subprime mortgages, and so forth. The housing industry was a precipitating cause. The fundamental cause was this huge derivatives credit octopus that had been created that was bringing down all of them. But the real bailout of the banks did not occur with TARP. In fact, only half of TARP was actually spent by Hank Paulson. Hank Paulson wanted to force all the big commercial banks to take some of this money, then that would then allow the government to oversee how these banks were distributing their bonuses to themselves. But the big banks, you know, Chase and Wells and others, didn't want it. They said, no, we're not bankrupt. You know, we don't want the government into our pocket. You know, the government got into the pocket of AIG deep. They refused to take the money. Yeah. The big bailout of the banking system would come in the following year, 2009, and that would be financed by the Federal Reserve, creating what was called quantitative easing. In other words, we're going to print money electronically, right? And we're going to just throw it at everybody, every sector of the financial system that looked like it was in trouble. We're going to buy up their bad bonds, all these bad subprimes and so forth. We're going to buy them up at above market prices at the time. In other words, we're going to subsidize the whole banking financial industry in the process here. And that's what occurred, to the tune of somewhere between $4.5 and $6 trillion over the next several years, up until 2016. Yeah, it was the Federal Reserve that really bailed out the banks and the financial system. And of course, what it did was take all these bad loans and bonds, even from private investors, and put it on its own debt balance sheet, the Fed did. And that's why the Federal Reserve balance sheet was $4 to $6 trillion in debt. And now the Fed's trying to sell that off. Okay. So the bad debt was simply moved from private sector and banks and investors onto the government Federal Reserve sector. But that's the role of central banks, you see. Central banks were all created to bail out the financial system, the private banks, whenever they got in trouble. That was its primary purpose. Read my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes. That was behind the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913. That was the whole purpose, right, of the Federal Reserve. Okay, so we won't go there. We've talked about that before. You know, the essential point is the 2008 crash. What caused it? Well, subprimes played a role, but it was the massive debt and excess liquidity provided by central banks, the Fed, for decades before, that fueled all this debt, easy money and debt, the rise of all this debt in the housing market, but in the derivatives market in general, everywhere. And of course, technology played a role, and deregulation played a role. It allowed the creation of all these derivatives and financial securities. That was all part of the game, too. And politics played a role. The government, the state, took sides and maneuvered with the commercial banks and others to bail out the system. So the government, the state, is a contributor here to the whole process of financial instability and crash. Government policies, particularly monetary policies, play a big role in precipitating and bailing out, enabling rather, and bailing out. Right? So when Dean Baker debates with the New York Times, right, and talks about subprime mortgages being the cause, sole cause of the crisis, he's leaving out a much more complex picture of the whole derivative structure, of the whole financial speculation, and not just deregulation and technology, but the role of politics and government. It's much more complex than just subprime mortgages. And it's much more complex today than to say, oh, corporate bonds are not a problem. Okay, corporate bonds could be very much a problem. They may not precipitate the crisis, although I wouldn't totally rule that out, because as I said earlier, you know, over half of all corporate debt and city municipal debt in this country is junk debt. In other words, highly, highly costly, unstable junk, high interest rates, right? By debt that's been added by corporations and cities that can't really afford to pay it off. And when you have a crisis of collapsing prices, then the income to pay off that principal and interest and debt disappears. It collapses, right? And you can't make the payments on the principal and interest, and therefore you go bankrupt. And as you approach bankruptcy, speculators jump in and drive down your capital, in other words, your stock values, right, by shorting it, and that makes your ability to pay principal and interest even worse. Speculators play a role in this, right? Central bankers play a role in this. It's not a simple linear explanation of subprime mortgages, right, being the cause of the whole crisis. That's just the appearance. That's just the tip of the iceberg. Now, fast forward to where we are today. And as I said at the beginning, right, we got emerging markets. Aren't they in a similar situation? I'm talking about, you know, the most exposed here, Argentina, Turkey, now South Africa, Indonesia next, right? India, perhaps, after it. Brazil, of course. Aren't they in the same situation? Think about it. They've loaded up on massive amounts of dollarized debt. They've borrowed all this dollarized debt from American banks, northern banks, you know, European, American, northern banks, huge amounts. And now their currency is collapsing. The currency is collapsing once again because the U.S. rates and the dollar is rising. If the dollar rises, their currency collapses, right? Their currency is collapsing because speculators are shorting it and driving it down. Their currency is collapsing because the global economy and trade is slowing down, and it's clear they can't earn dollars from exporting more. So all those forces mean they have lost income to pay the principal and interest on their debt, which leads to more shorting and so forth, right? They don't have the money. Well, when you don't have the money, what do you do? Well, in the case of Argentina, they go and borrow dollars from the IMF. But the IMF says, okay, you want to borrow money from us. We want to make sure you can pay it back. And we want you to pay it back by squeezing your population with austerity. In other words, run a budget surplus, which means you have to cut your social spending, cut your medical social programs, cut your education programs to generate a surplus, a budget surplus, in order to pay we, the IMF, who loaned you the money, to pay the northern banks from which you borrowed dollars. Now, in the case of Argentina, it's particularly severe because when the U.S. engineered the coup, helped engineer with the cooperation of business interests in Argentina, engineered the takeover of the Macri government a couple years ago in Argentina. Argentina then borrowed money from U.S. banks to pay off the hedge funds from the last crisis, similar for Argentina, in 2001. So they borrowed money and then some to pay off the hedge funds they borrowed from the northern banks in dollars, and they're up to their elbows in dollarized debt, and now we get the currency crisis and all the rest and inability to pay, right? Inability to earn money from exports, inability to attract foreign direct investment dollars, inability to generate dollars from trade. So they have to borrow dollars from the IMF to pay the U.S. banks because they borrowed from the U.S. banks in order to pay the U.S. hedge funds. This is financial imperialism. A new form of imperialism I've been writing about and talking about in great detail. Read my blog, jackrasmus.com, and I'll be writing shortly on the blog this whole situation in Argentina. And Turkey is next, heavily dollarized debt borrowing. So those countries that are deep in dollarized debt are the ones that have to go to the IMF, and they're the ones the IMF says, okay, squeeze your populace, right? Extract the value from your populace to pay us our principal and interest. This is what exactly happened in Greece as well over the last decade, except the whole process was engineered with Northern European banks and Germany and its allies in the Eurozone. It was a microcosm of what goes on, has been going on with the U.S. globally. It went on internally within the Eurozone. Same thing, right? Get indebted to the banks, you got to borrow from the IMF. In this case, they borrowed from the IMF, the European Commission, and European Central Bank altogether, called the Troika. And 95% of all the payments on the principal and interest end up in Northern European banks. Well, this is financial imperialism, a new kind of imperialism, quite different from traditional forms of imperialism in the 19th and 20th century. Well, it's going on right now as well with these countries like Argentina. Turkey's refusing to go and borrow money from the IMF, because it went through this process once before as well, but it will be forced to do so probably at some point. So, you know, to sort of sum up, we got something very similar going on with the collapse of the currencies, thus the income, to pay the principal and interest on the debt by these emerging markets. And as U.S. rates and dollar continues to rise, the squeeze gets tighter on these emerging markets. And as the global economy trade slows and Trump threatens trade instability, they have less money to pay off the dollarized debt, and they have to borrow from the IMF, right? And they raise their interest rates to prevent money from flowing out of their economies. All these things are at play here, all of them. So emerging markets, let's watch them very closely and watch the contagion effects between the different financial markets as well as between the different countries and economies. And at some point, the contagion between currency markets, stock markets, bond markets may worsen to a point in these economies that it spills over to the advanced economies in North America, Europe, and Northeast Asia. Mm-hmm. So we are approaching perhaps something very similar to 2008 on a global economy scale, with the locus of financial instability in the emerging markets, particularly these leading edge markets. Okay, we will be talking more about financial contagion and financial instability, and my term financial fragility, which is an estimator of fragility, of instability, here in coming weeks. This is the 10th anniversary of the September 2008 global crash. And are we moving towards another one? Yes. Exactly where? Who knows? Exactly when? Can't say, although it appears to be getting closer. Okay. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Next week, we will return to these global themes. In the meantime, check out my blog, jackrasmus.com, for an article written on the myth of rising wages in the U.S. and on Amazon, the job killer. Walk the streets as free.